You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Blue Jays reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, as we get closer to spring training, we are going to focus in on the Blue Jays infield this week on the podcast. It's a spot that's obviously changed a bit since 2016 when you look at the right side and particularly first base, obviously. But before we dig our teeth into that, we got to look at the outfield quickly because as we record this, I guess the ink is not yet signed yet, but Jose Bautista appears headed back to the Toronto Blue Jays. How did this come about? Because it seemed like it wasn't very likely a couple months ago.
Yeah, it really took a long time to get to this point. There's no question about it. And really, in a lot of ways, this wasn't plan A, B, or C for the Blue Jays. I mean, the first priority was to re-sign Edwin Encarnacion once they realized that wasn't going to happen. They tried to move on to Dexter Fowler, and that didn't work out either. And eventually, here we are in the middle of January, and the Blue Jays are still looking for a middle-of-the-order type bat. They had at least one hole, possibly two in the outfield. And Bautista was the best player available by quite a long stretch. And from Bautista's standpoint, I don't think he ever really wanted to leave town. I think he was the one who was hoping that this would work out all along. But certainly his first priority was to get a multi-year deal somewhere, multi-year guaranteed deal somewhere. And his market never really developed quite as expected. And so he found himself still looking for a deal this time as well. And it really is a situation where both parties didn't get what they wanted done early on. And here they were, and they were still ended up being a perfect match, and it still could end up being a win-win for both sides.
Now, it's a one-year deal with, I guess, it sounds like mutual options at this point. Do you see that coming to fruition, or is this likely a situation where Bautista is going to be in Toronto for one more year, and then we'll see from there?
Yeah, I think this is both sides are really approaching this kind of as a one-year deal. I mean, mutual options rarely ever get picked up by both parties. I think it allows both sides to save face a little bit. But I think for the most part, this is going to be a one-year deal. And then you'll have a situation where next year where Bautista will be able to re-enter the market. And, last year he was, as we touched on before, he was coming off a bit of a down season. And if he can get back to his 2015 level, I mean, he's not going to keep playing forever. He's in his late 30s, but he still has an opportunity to hit the market again next offseason and get that multi-year deal he was looking for.
So they won't get a draft pick as compensation for Bautista as he signs, but they still get the one for Encarnacion still. So a good situation as far as the draft goes. Were they really hoping, though, to have those two extra first-rounders?
Well, I think one thing that they really wanted to do this offseason that they didn't really get accomplished was they did want to get younger. They wanted to get more athletic, and they wanted to get a little bit more speed, and they wanted to get more from the left side of the plate. And for the most part, this offseason was supposed to be the big period of transition. But, if you look at the roster, with the exception of swapping out Edwin Encarnacion for Kendrys Morales, I mean, this is a roster that is mostly intact. And to be honest with you, I don't think that's a bad thing. This team obviously went to the ALCS 2 years in a row. They're not getting any younger, but there is still a window of opportunity for this current core. And so I think maintaining the course for a little while longer, to me, that's what made sense all along. And it's going to take time to make that next transition. And so that's where one of the draft picks will come into play. I'm sure they would have loved to have had a second one. But to me, there's just way more value in having Bautista and everything he brings to a team that expects to contend in 2017 as opposed to taking that extra pick.
Yeah, keep this window open as long as you can before shutting it and looking ahead to the next window for sure. All right, let's focus in on the infield. And it's obviously an infield that has some star power, but not quite as much as it did in the past. Let's go left to right because no better way to start than the 2015 most valuable player in the American League, Josh Donaldson, who was almost as good in 2016. I mean, he was right there again. Every reason to believe that this guy is going to be an MVP-type caliber player for the next several years.
Yeah, and I mean, you look back now the last 4 years, he's finished top 10 in the MVP voting dating back to his final 2 years in Oakland. And the one thing that you can really depend on, or at least the Jays hope you can depend on, is this is a guy who's been able to answer the bell pretty much every single day. I mean, he's been in I think 154, at least those games in each of the last 4 years as well. Very, very durable. Someone who's been able to play through injuries when they do pop up. And obviously the Blue Jays will take anything close to that. And then in terms of production, there's no reason to expect anything else. I mean, Josh Donaldson is now a proven hitter. He's one of the obviously the most valuable players in all of baseball. And I'd expect more of the same in 2017.
When you look at shortstop, there's a guy that was once upon a time a most valuable player type of player in Troy Tulowitzki. In his time in Toronto, since they got him at the deadline back in 2015, he hasn't really played up to that level, but he's still a very good player when he's healthy. Is that the biggest issue with Tulo, somehow getting him so he's in the lineup 140 times this season?
Yeah, that's certainly one of the main issues. And then, you know, even last year, for the most part, he was able to stay healthy. He still had that one stint. But especially after he came back from that, he was able to put together a decent season. But, you know, the tale with him, I mean, everybody knows that you're going to get the Gold Glove caliber defense. That's there. That's as consistent as it gets. But we've really seen, you know, two different sides of Tulowitzki at the plate since he joined the Blue Jays in Toronto. And, you know, last year he got off to that very, very slow start where it really looked like he was totally lost to the plate. And there was some legitimate questions about whether or not he was going to be able to get it back. I mean, he just did look that bad for a pretty long stretch. But then, you know, later on in the season, from the middle of May on, he really turned things around and started to show, you know, the Tulowitzki of old, not quite at that level that he was at in Colorado, but still a very plus bat. And the Jays are going to need more of that latter stages to really come through this season, especially if they're going to bounce back after, you know, somewhat of a disappointing offensive performance in 2016, despite of all of what they accomplished. And you replace Encarnacion with Morales, someone else is going to have to come up and step up. And Tulowitzki does have the talent to be that guy. And it's going to be interesting to see how much upside there is left in that bat.
In 2016, because of injuries, Toronto started the year at second base. They had Ryan Goins, Darwin Barney, and they were just kind of waiting for Devin Travis and hoping that Devin Travis would be the guy that showed sparks of being great in 2015. Now you got a full season coming of Devin Travis, and he's going to have a full spring training. How important is that for him?
That's going to be big, and staying healthy is going to be similar to Tulowitzki. It's going to be very, very big for Devin Travis and very big for this team because the Jays don't have a prototypical leadoff type guy. They tried to slot Batista in there last year. I think ideally they'd move him down into the middle of the order, and that opens the door for a guy like Travis. And he auditioned in that role for a while last year, did very well in it. And then I think a lot of people saw what happens to this team when he's taken out of the lineup. When he left the game in game one against Cleveland, that, you know, really weakened the rest of that entire lineup, caused some changes to be made. And so he's at this point in time, he's a proven bat, even though he doesn't have a ton of service time at this point. I think, but for the most part, I think people know what to expect from him as well. It's just a matter of him staying healthy on the field and having the time to actually show that.
And that brings us to first base, which is the biggest difference from 2016. Instead of Edwin Encarnacion, you have Kendrys Morales, you have Justin Smoke on this roster, you have Steve Pearce as well. How do all those guys fit into the first base DH role?
Yeah, well, Morales, they're going to look as a full-time DH. I think very rarely are you going to see him ever play the field. They're obviously going to have to get a little creative during early play, but outside of that, I wouldn't expect much. And so this is that first base is really going to come down to a platoon with Smoke and Steve Pearce. And I think the Jays are pretty comfortable with what they're going to get from Pearce against left-handed pitching. To me, the big question is whether or not Pearce is going to force his way into getting some playing time against righties as well. And really that all comes down to how well Justin Smoke starts the year. I mean, the Blue Jays put a lot of faith in Justin Smoke around the All-Star break last year when they gave him a two-year extension that really kind of came out of nowhere. It wasn't really expected whatsoever at the time, but they brought him back on that two-year deal, guaranteed him an extra 2 years. And he's someone who's had an awful lot of trouble making contact. I mean, the power is there. I guess you could say the upside is there, but you know, he's not a young guy. He's someone who's tried to put it together at the big league level for a very long period of time. And so, if he starts off well, he'll secure that job. If not, then Steve Pearce, if he's able to stay healthy, might become a little bit more than just a platoon play over at first base.
So with Smoke and Pearce at first and Morales obviously as the DH, you look at the bench here. Is there room on this 25-man roster for Ryan Goins and Darwin Barney, or is that a bit of a battle in spring training?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be, and I think this is shaping up to be a pretty long year for Ryan Goins. I mean, it seems like Darwin Barney is going to be that utility infielder for this team. That was his primary role last year as well, and then when he signed a deal to avoid arbitration, that really kind of eliminated any of the lingering questions, I think. And Ryan Goins is looking at this team right now, and he's going to need an injury to make the roster. And you know, certainly we've seen before guys entering spring training without a guaranteed job. Something happens and they find their way onto the roster, and it's not that big of a deal. But if everyone is healthy by opening day, I don't really see any other scenario but Ryan Goins having to go through waivers. And I think that's a situation where the Blue Jays would certainly hope he clears, because they need to have some depth in the upper levels in the minor leagues. And Goins is a guy who was used to going up and down between those levels. It was a nice luxury to have. It's not going to be quite so easy for the Blue Jays to treat him in the same way in 2017.
Yeah, that's kind of a dangerous, as far as waivers go, nerve-wracking process for the Blue Jays, right? Because, yeah, maybe there's no time spot for him on the 25 right now, but when you talk about depth and injuries, which are inevitable, there's not really anyone else. They kind of need him to be able to go down to the minor leagues.
Yeah, exactly. And it puts a player in limbo, too, for a long time. I mean, that's there's been a few players here over the years who have had to go through that waiver window multiple times in one season, and it's never pleasant. But particularly for this organization, I mean, that's just the exact role that Goins has had for a long time, where he's been that guy, that glue guy, that 26th man who's been able to go up and down. And when you take those options away from him, it makes things a lot tougher. And in this case, a lot tougher on both sides.
All right, great stuff as always, Gregor. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Blue Jays edition. Next week, we'll tackle the outfield, and of course, we'll talk more about Jose Bautista when we get to the Blue Jays outfield a week from now. All right, for Gregor Chisholm, I'm Tim McMaster. Thanks for tuning in. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Orioles reporter, Brittany Giroli. We covered the starting rotation a week ago on the podcast. This week, we move on to the bullpen. So from what could be a weakness to one of the real strengths of this Orioles club, both a year ago and they certainly hope again this year. When you talk about this Orioles bullpen, Brittany, you got to start with the closer, and he was the best in the business in 2016. There's all the talk about all those big guys out there that got the big money in the offseason, but if you look at the numbers, Zach Britton was the best closer in baseball in 2016. 2-1, the ERA, about a half a run per nine. He struck out 74 in 67 innings. Is there any chance he can replicate that season in 2017, or do you almost have to assume there's at least going to be a little bit of regression?
I don't know if you can replicate that. I think, Tim, that might be one of the best seasons that we ever see from a reliever during our lifetime. I mean, certainly remarkable what he was able to do, and I do think he's a guy who is going to be able to compete at a high level for them. Certainly they hope that he doesn't have a down year, but I don't know if it's possible to demand of anybody to have another year like Zach Britton had. I think if he blows one or two saves, no one's going to get too upset, as long as more often than not, he's their guy. And when you look at the stuff he has, being such a dominant sinker ball pitcher, I don't see a huge drop-off coming. There wasn't a whole lot of luck involved with Zach Britton, so I think he's going to have another good year. Maybe not quite as historic as this past year, but still something they can very much count on at the end of the game.
Yeah, I guess maybe the only luck is the fact that at some point you would think you'd have bad luck and blow a save at some point over the course of a season, and he was able to avoid that bad luck, and he was just unbelievable. And the great thing about this bullpen for the Orioles is the depth that they have behind Britton as well. And last year, as far as that setup role, it kind of changed hands a little bit. Going into the year, it looked like Darren O'Day would be the obvious guy to pitch the eighth throughout the season. But because of injuries, Brad Brock was thrown into that role and really thrived in it. You look at the numbers for Brock, the ERA right at 2. He had the strikeouts. He ended up winning 10 games. So when you look at the setup role heading into 2017, is Brad Brock the guy that gets most of the duty in the eighth inning?
That's actually an interesting question. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because Darren O'Day, they're assuming, is going to be healthy and a full go in spring training. He was supposed to be kind of that setup man. But as you mentioned, Brad Brock had such a good year. They're kind of in a situation where maybe they can play matchups. Maybe they can afford to really rotate those two guys, you know, depending on, say, Brock pitched two nights in a row, get him that third game off. Right now, it appears that they have a lot of late-inning arms, and that's a luxury. They can really shorten up the game. Even if you decide, hey, let's put Brad Rock in the seventh inning, that seventh, eighth, and ninth inning for the Orioles is just ridiculous. So I think right now there's not a setup guy per se. There's not a one guy that you would say, okay, he's always going to get the ball in the eighth. I think Brad Rock has certainly deserved the late inning chances that he got. He certainly made the most of them this past year. And like I said, I think what the Orioles plan to do with this bullpen, Tim, and that's why they didn't want to trade anyone away out of it, is shorten the game up. Get five-inning starts and then put in a bullpen for four innings a night that's completely shut down. And that's how they were able to be so successful last year, really over the last couple of years. And that's what they're planning to do again. So I don't think there's going to be too many defined roles outside of Zach Britton.
Certainly a formula that has worked for a lot of teams in recent years. The Royals kind of started it off. The Indians had such a great run in the postseason last year using that kind of thing as well, with three great guys down the stretch pitching seventh, eighth, and ninth. How about O'Day? Obviously, he just threw 31 innings last year, multiple injuries throughout the season. You expect him to be healthy. But even when he wasn't able to pitch all the time, how important is Darren O'Day, just having him out there in the bullpen? How big a leader is he in that bullpen?
Oh, I mean, he's such a veteran guy to have around. He's a really good, steady presence. You never really see him get too frustrated, too high or too low. I think he's a very intelligent guy, a really good guy for some of those rookies to have down in the bullpen. So I think you nailed it. I mean, even when he's not pitching, when he's hurt, he adds such a presence that it's very important for the Orioles, I think, especially because they have some young guys and they've had a bunch of young guys really kind of rely on that kind of thing. Michael Gibbons, Dylan Bundy. These are younger guys they had in the bullpen who I think Darren O'Day helped a lot. He kind of becomes another extension, really, of the bullpen and pitching coach. And hopefully he is healthy, because obviously when a veteran like that plays a big role in team success, it only helps matters. But I think for the Orioles, when they look at the contributions that Darren O'Day gives, it doesn't just boil down to numbers and figures.
And you mentioned he's such a veteran, and he says all the right things when he's interviewed, but you're in that clubhouse every day. How frustrating was 2016 for him on a personal level?
Oh, God. It was very frustrating. And he kind of equated it to a few years ago when he had hip surgery, and he tried to rush and come back and ultimately wasn't able to get the job done. Then he ended up on waivers, and the Orioles picked him up, and he's really surged since coming to Baltimore 2 years ago, and he's hoping that that's all behind him when he is healthy. If you look at those numbers, they're very good. So I think for Darren O'Day, watching from the sidelines is something that he didn't like. He had to learn to be a little bit more patient than I think he would have liked, because he came back and from that hamstring issue that took a while, then he hurt his arm. So for Darren O'Day, I think he's very glad that 2016 is over. He said when we saw him last month that he didn't think there'd be any kind of carryover. It should be a normal, healthy offseason, but definitely a really frustrating year for him.
All right, so that's the big three, but there's more talented arms down there in that bullpen than just that. You mentioned Michael Gibbons. He's one of the younger guys. Is he kind of the next in line as far as the bullpen goes, as a guy that Buck Showalter can go to with complete confidence?
Yeah. There's a couple of them. For sure, they do have some youth down there, but I think he's a guy who's intriguing. He's a guy the organization likes. And he's a guy who they think can help them win. So certainly a guy to keep an eye on as we move forward into next season. We mentioned those big names, the Brocks, the O'Days, the Brittons, but really what helps teams win are those guys who help them get through the fifth and sixth inning when the starter can't. So I think he's another key part of this unit.
They don't necessarily have that lefty, that shutdown lefty you can bring in to get a big at-bat. But when you look at lefties in general, obviously the closer, Zach Britton's a lefty. And then Donnie Hart is a lefty. Is he a situational guy in 2017 that they can use to get a key lefty?
Yeah, he's definitely a guy who's high on their radar. And it's funny because a year ago he was at their minicamp and kind of rose up through the ranks and has done a really good job. And he's definitely the guy who jumps to mind when you talk about filling that hole of a lefty that, of course, is not Britton because you can't use him earlier in the game. So Donnie Hart is one. T.J. McFarland is more of their lefty long man as an option as well. But they had Brian Mattis for several years, and he wasn't able to really get the job done. So they'd rather have a right-handed pitcher capable of getting out than a lefty specialist who's struggling. So Hart's the guy who would really fill that role, but it's not a necessity for them. They've gotten by without one for large periods of time and been okay.
Mike Wright fits in the role, I guess, as a swing guy. He could be a guy that ends up in a rotation, depending on what happens with that rotation. And then a new face, Logan Verrett, I know is a lot's going to be depend on him, I guess, as well. Brittany, how high are the Orioles on Logan Verrett, a guy who was with the Mets for some years?
Really high. Mike Wright is an interesting case. He was at their mini camp that I was at a few weeks ago, and he's a guy who I think they really want to figure it out as a starter, ideally. But if not, he could probably throw upper 90s out of the bullpen and be a real commanding presence. Logan Verrett is a guy that they had in the Rule 5 draft that they weren't able to keep. Ultimately, they had him, Jason Garcia. They were able to keep Garcia in their system, lost Verrett. This past winter, he was available. They made the trade with the Mets. And I think what he's going to end up doing is being kind of like the Vance Worley from a year ago. He's going to be the long guy, the spot starter if need be. They really like him. They've always liked him. And he's probably going to fill that innings eater role that every staff needs, one of those guys. And he looks to be the front runner going into spring training to be that guy.
When you look across baseball and certainly American League, it's tough to find a deeper bullpen, I think, than what we just talked about with this Orioles team. Certainly within the division, I don't think anybody can really compete. The Yankees obviously have the great 1-2 with Betances and Chapman at the top, but after that, I think there's certainly more of a drop-off than this Orioles team. If they're going to contend in 2017, is this kind of the key, that this bullpen has to be as good as it looks on paper?
Absolutely. There's no other way. Either that or everybody collectively in the starting rotation has to take a big jump forward. But even then, if you don't get it done in the seventh, eighth, and ninth, those are the worst kind of losses. I mean, those are bad clubhouses to be in. Those are the kind of ones that really hurt, that really can carry over for a few days. So the bullpen, to me, is probably the biggest key. The bullpen and the offense carry them all of last year. They're going to be relied on to do probably a similar thing in 2017. If the Orioles are going to be able to go out there and compete.
All right, great stuff, Brittany. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Orioles edition. For Brittany Jolie, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Yankees reporter, Brian Hoke. We continue to talk about the roster, and we're going to get into the infield a little bit on the podcast this week, go around the horn. But before we get to that, Brian, the Yankees celebrating their first maybe annual, I'm assuming annual, winter warm-up this week. A lot of players were in New York City, veterans and some of the young guys, even prospects who haven't even made it up to the big leagues yet. It took place over a number of days with the players getting to a lot of different locations, and I know you were along for the ride for a lot of it. How did it all play out being the first one of these for the Yankees?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think it actually might wind up being an annual thing. Yeah, you know, it's a good opportunity for the Yankees to get these young kids that you mentioned up to New York and have them meet the fans and get a feel for the city. And, you know, it was my first opportunity to actually get some time to talk with guys like Clint Frazier and Gleyber Torres and Chance Adams and Justice Sheffield and these names that you've been hearing about, because the Yankees are obviously in the middle of a transition here where they're trying to get some of that young talent to the big leagues. And, you know, the Yankees never needed to have a winter caravan to teach Alex Rodriguez or Derek Jeter what New York was all about. But this is a different phase for the franchise, and I think it's fun. I think that the players enjoyed it, the public enjoyed it, and guys like Gary Sanchez getting behind the counter and at a deli across the street from Yankee Stadium. It's cool photo ops. It's good experience, and they get to spend some quality time with their teammates. So I think it's all positive. I could definitely see the Yankees wanting to do more of that in the future.
Yeah, and it gets people thinking about baseball with less than a month to go before pitchers and catchers report down to Tampa. Let's get into the infield a little bit. We'll go around the horn. There's veterans there. There's also, you know, some of that youth will certainly be a part of this infield as well. Let's start at the hot corner and work our way around. Chase Headley, another solid season in 2016. This is a guy who's been kind of the same guy throughout his career. He's consistent. He was that way in San Diego, and he's been that way since he came across to the Yankees. Is he just the solid guy you can count on for at least 140 games at third base this year going into 2017?
Well, I think health-wise, as long as his back holds up, you should probably be able to pencil that in. But the real thing for Chase is he needs to get off to a better start. His April was brutal. He didn't have an extra base hit for the entire month. But then if you go back and look at the numbers from about the time of his birthday, which I believe is May 9, through the end of the year, he was pretty decent. I believe he hit about 270 and showed some power. The defense was much better. He worked hard on that to improve after he committed a career high in errors the year before. So I think that it was a frustrating year for Headley, particularly because he felt he was hurting the team in April. And if you go back and look, the Yankees wound up with 84 wins. And if they win a few more games in April, you can say, hey, maybe they're a wildcard team. So I think that he wasn't happy with the year as a whole. He thought he played better from May on, but he's going to look to put together a more complete season in 2017.
When you move over to shortstop, Didi Gregorius put together the most solid season of his career and showed the power. 20 home runs for Didi, that's a career high. If there's one thing that maybe he has to work on, the on-base percentage is 304 for 2016. It's never been real high for Didi within his career, but he really seemed comfortable as a Yankee in 2016.
Yeah, I think he kind of came into his own. Yeah. Before you're taking over for Derek Jeter, and there were a lot of those questions, and even though he said it didn't really play in his mind a whole lot, you're kind of competing with a ghost there. So I think to get that first year under the belt, you come back, and really where I saw the biggest improvement was against left-handed pitching. I think that that was a concern when he came to the Yankees. They were even talking about maybe having to platoon him with Brendan Ryan as a lefty-righty thing. That turned out not to be the case. Didi had, I believe, the third highest average against left-handed pitching in the major leagues for any left-handed hitter this year. So, and you know, talking to Alan Cockrell, the hitting coach, yesterday, he believes these changes can carry over. He believes this can be a consistent thing going into 2017. So I think you're seeing the athletic talent catch up with the ability right now. He's putting it all together. And look, you know, he's a line drive hitter. He's a gap-to-gap guy. But if he hits it hard enough, the ball's going to go out of the ballpark a little bit. He was rewarded 20 times with that, 21, I believe. So, if the Yankees can get another year like that out of Didi Gregorius, they'll be very happy.
Is he going to end up spending some time looking over his shoulder a little bit after the addition of Gleyber Torres and the expectations of what kind of player he can be as a middle infielder? Is Didi as comfortable as he looked last year, and the fact that he kind of made that shortstop position his, suddenly this new kid is in the organization and is maybe nipping on your heels a little bit?
You know, that question's been asked a bunch. You know, I do the mailbags every week, and I think that Didi's pretty locked in at short. He's obviously aware of Torres, as he was aware of Jorge Mateo, but these are names that are coming up through the minor league system. For 2017, I think it's obviously Didi, and I think going forward, there's no guarantee that Torres has to come to the major league level as a shortstop. I think that you could create a vacancy just as easily at second base or third base if you really want to get that bat in the lineup. So I think that for the time being, Didi feels pretty secure at shortstop. Certainly every time I've talked to him, that hasn't been an issue. And, you know, going forward, maybe there's going to be a spot in the infield, but it doesn't necessarily have to be shortstop for Torres.
And third base is an interesting point because of everything you said about Headley. And obviously Headley, a little older than these other guys as well. All right, second base, you got 20 home runs from Didi Gregorius at shortstop, and you get over 20 home runs from Starlin Castro at second base. This Yankee team actually had some pop up the middle that you don't always see. Now, for Castro, it was kind of that power that I think everybody always anticipated would kind of come for him. I remember when the Yankees traded for Castro and he came over, I did an interview with Jim Duquette about it, and he said in that interview a few years ago, there's a guy who's going to hit 20-25 home runs per season once he kind of figures that part of it out. And it seemed like 2016 was the beginning of that power, and this, it's an exciting middle of the infield for this Yankees team.
Yeah, it's something the Yankees have, believe it or not, they've never had a second baseman and shortstop combination to both hit 20 or more home runs in a single season. You think back to some of the great names in Yankee history, obviously Jeter, but they've also had Robbie Cano and Alfonso Soriano, and I mean, you can go back to Tony Lazzari and Joe Gordon. It has never happened. So I think that was a pretty crazy statistical fluke. With Castro, he was streaky last year. I mean, you remember he got off to a great start. He had 8 RBIs in his first 3 games, and everybody said if he keeps up at this pace, he's going to have 250 RBIs. Obviously, it didn't work out that way. But I think that the most drastic thing with Castro was the home road splits. If you go back and look, he hit over 300 at Yankee Stadium. 15 of his home runs came there in 70-something games, and he played about the same number of games on the road, and the numbers dropped precipitously. So I think that Castro, his best months were April and August, you go back and look, but when he was cold, he was really cold. So I think that putting together a more consistent year will be big for Starlin Castro, and Cubs people have talked about that for years. So I think that maybe that's what he is. Maybe he's just the kind of guy that when he gets hot, he can carry the team. But they certainly like to have more highs than lows.
Then we finish off the infield at first base, which is, I guess, the biggest question mark as you head into 2017. Tyler Austin obviously made his debut late in 2016. Greg Bird, what a great start to his career in 2015, but then the injury, and he misses all of last season. So if you have the two young guys. How does this play out, Brian? I mean, who's going to be the first baseman on opening day?
Yeah, my guess is, you know, based on the ability alone, I would say Bird. But you go back and you're thinking now, health-wise, that's probably the only thing that can trip up Greg Bird. He looked fine when he came in the Arizona Fall League. He only DH, didn't play any first base just for health reasons. But he's coming off a shoulder procedure, and so they might take it a little slow with him. But they say the swing looks about the same as it did in 2015. He obviously came up late in the year, hit 11 home runs, and really helped that team down the stretch when Mark Teixeira was hurt. So it's going to be a new face no matter what. It's hard to believe that 8 years went by with Teixeira so quickly. It really feels like it flew by. But they got a World Series win out of it, a couple of playoff appearances, and now it's time for somebody else to take over at first base. And you know, it's possible it could be a lefty-righty platoon. You can have Bird against right-handed pitching and Austin against lefties, but there's no guarantee there. I think that if Bird comes in and has the kind of camp he's capable of, he could be the everyday first baseman. And if not, Tyler Austin might force his way onto the roster. So I think that they've created some options there. But I think either way they go, I think Bird would be the preference, but Austin could handle a job as well.
Considering Austin is obviously still developing and a young player, if he's not going to get regular playing time, is he more likely to start the year in AAA as opposed to being a bench guy where you're limiting his at-bats?
That would be my thought, yeah. And the Yankees are going to bring in some depth guys. They signed Choi, who was with the Angels last year, and he didn't do much. But, you know, this is a guy, a veteran guy who can come in and maybe serve off the bench as a backup. Certainly not something anybody should get too excited about, but I think that if the Yankees have Greg Bird in the majors and Tyler Austin waiting at AAA, or vice versa, I guess they could go that way. I think that would be a good situation for them.
Then when you look at this bench, where does Rob Refsnyder fit into this roster at this point? You know, he's tried different things and mixed results, I guess, at this point. What is the team's viewpoint of him heading into 2017?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that if he was going to be a starting player, it would be in right field, but I don't see that happening with the Yankees. I think that his best case to make it in New York is to continue working on that versatility. I feel like people have almost forgotten about him a little bit because you've heard about all these other prospects that are coming up. But this is a guy, the bat was there 2 years ago, not so much last year. He didn't hit for a whole lot of power, but I think he can force his way onto the roster if he proves he's capable at second base, first base, third base. Third base didn't go very well for him last year, but that would be a really nice thing to put in the skill set. He could play both of the outfield corners. They have Ronald Torres, who's kind of a jack of all trades, but Refsnyder could be a valuable piece for the Yankees. I think that if he wound up on the roster, there would be a way to get him at bat. It's just, you know, will that opportunity present itself?
This has been MLB.com Extras, our Yankees edition. We'll continue to dig into different parts of the roster as we get closer and closer to spring training. But for Brian Hoke, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with Bill Chastain, our MLB.com Rays reporter. An exciting week for the Rays. We're going to continue on the podcast this week, our breakdowns of the roster heading into 2017 as we focus on the infield of the 2017 Rays. But before we get to that, Bill, the Rays finally pull the trigger and trade a starter. The rumors have been swirling throughout the offseason, and in the end, Drew Smyly is the guy that's headed away, and he's headed to the Seattle Mariners. The Rays get three young players in return, two that you would technically classify as prospects, and then there's Malik Smith, who was a prospect a year ago but played a little too much for the Braves to still fit into that mold. But I want to talk about him first. He's an outfielder, missed 3 months last year basically with a broken finger, but in his time in Atlanta, he kind of started to show what he can do, and And the first thing he can do is he can run. He's fast. He's an outfielder who can really fly. The question marks around him, I guess, are if he's ever going to hit enough. What do the Rays like most about him?
Well, they like his age. He's, I believe he's 23. He's, like you said, he runs crazy. I mean, he's supposedly, you know, and we really hadn't seen much like that kind of speed around the Rays, save for maybe Kevin Kiermaier since Crawford and Upton left. So that's something they've lacked. So I just think that gives them a young guy who's got great athleticism and could be an impact guy.
Now, with Rasmus signed, obviously, earlier in the week, how does that work out in the outfield? Does Malik Smith start the season in the big leagues?
You know what? It's a crazy situation. At the first of the week, it was everybody's kind of wondering what was going to happen with their outfield. Now it's more confused than what it was at the beginning of the week, and they've made two moves. So, you know, you wonder what's going to happen with Rasmus and Dickerson. You know, will one of them be in left, one of them at DH, and then what do you do with Smith? Does Smith play some right field? You know, and his main position is center. So are you going to, you know, you got Kevin Kiermaier in center, who's probably the best fielder at any position in baseball. So it's just kind of interesting. It's going to, they said they wanted to build up their depth, and they've done that. But I'm kind of the mind that they'll probably make some other move. And, of course, you know, a lot of these guys have options too.
Right, so you don't have to necessarily. You can start somebody in AAA, certainly, and Malik Smith might be a candidate for that because of coming off the injury and everything. Well, when you trade pitching, if you're the Rays, you want to get pitching back as well, and that was also part of this deal. Ryan Yarbrough, a left-hander, which is nice as well, and he's a guy with some upside, and he's not that far away either.
Yeah, Eric Neander yesterday said, you know, speaking for the Rays, said that he's got a, you know, really good fastball, has a nice changeup and a breaking ball. So he's coming off a good season. So he doesn't think he's that far away. Of course, it's a pretty crowded field there, you know, Rays starters already. So, you know, anything he needs to do to develop, I'm sure he's going to be given, you know, the right amount of time.
Yeah, certainly no rush, and he'll start the year, I would think, probably down in AA. We'll see where he goes from there. And then the third piece to this deal is Carlos Vargas, and he's kind of the wild card in the deal. He's only 17 years old, plays a premium position as a shortstop, and he's one of these guys that the upside is there that he could become a very good, great player, but he's 17 years old. But, you know, you can never have too many of those guys in your system.
Oh, no, and I mean, actually, they've got some pretty good shortstops at the top part of their minor leagues right now, too, you know, beginning with number one prospect, Willy Adames. But like you say, this guy is 17, and he's a guy that Rays scouts have had an eye on, you know, down, you know, where he's from. And they had interest in him. And, you know, it is kind of like, you know, a long shot. You know, anytime you banking on somebody 17 at very low level, there's a lot of levels to achieve in before you get there. So I would consider that a long shot. You know, most of them don't work out, but it looks like he was worth taking a chance on.
So we'll go from an infielder that may not find his way to the Rays for 4, 5, 6 years, who knows, until to the current infield. And when you talk about the Rays and the infield, you got to start at third base because that's been the position, Bill, that's just been locked down for so many years now. Evan Longoria coming off a real strong season in 2016. He doesn't seem like he's slowing down at all. Do you expect the same from Longoria this season?
I don't see any reason not to. You know, he seems really comfortable. He's at that point in his career where he, you know, really is confident in what he's doing. He knows the game. He's smart. And, you know, he's playing a lot of games. He's not breaking down. Like, I always thought that would be a big concern the way he was early in his career. But, you know, this guy's the cornerstone of their lineup.
And then when you go around the horn, it's interesting because things look different than they did a year ago. Obviously, Brad Miller was brought in a year ago. They thought he may be the shortstop for a while, but then he's going to end up probably at first base. Matt Duffy, who they got at the trade deadline in that Matt Moore trade, will be the shortstop. When you look at Duffy, there was a small sample size as far as what he did with the Rays in 2016, and he was injured the whole time. So I don't think Rays fans really got a true, fair look at Duffy. But that said, he showed what he can do in the field and that he can be a solid player there at shortstop, something the Rays have been looking for some time.
Yeah, you know, he hadn't played shortstop in a couple of years because the Giants had him at third base. So it took a little while for him to get used to it again. But, you know, he just looks like a real shortstop. And
I really like watching the way the guy plays, and particularly if you remember too, like you said, he was injured. You know, he was in pain most of the whole time he was playing, and you know, he's got that fixed. I haven't heard of any setbacks. So having a real major league shortstop is a big deal.
And you look back to 2 years ago for Duffy, and you hope that's the kind of production he can provide at the plate as well, when he was very good for the San Francisco Giants before having kind of an off year in 2016 with the injury and everything as well. Moving across to second base and Logan Forsyth, team MVP, I guess, 2 years ago, the injury bug again last year. Is he the guy that is the key as far as top of the order and table setter for this Rays team?
I'm kind of interested to see what's going to happen, whether or not they're going to put Kiermaier leadoff or him. I think it's two good choices. They bring different things. Last year was the first year Forsythe hit leadoff, and he did a great job. But, you know, he kind of profiles as more of a guy who'd be hitting further down in the lineup. You know, like I said, I think Cash will have a nice decision there between those two. But, you know, he's as solid as he comes. And the thing in baseball is always being consistent. This guy's just consistent. His temperament's consistent. His play is consistent. You know, you just put him out there and you forget about second base.
How about the combination, Duffy Forsyth, as far as a double play combination? Is that going to be the way those guys can work together, we didn't really get to see much of it a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's something they'd probably like to work on, you know, and it's something that probably fans and sports writers and sports commentators, you know, the little tick of a second that we don't pick up. It's almost like when you see a player who is not an everyday player out there, it'll take you about a week to realize, you know, hey, that double play wasn't getting made when it, you know, it was just half a second off. So I look for them, you know, once they're working together to, you know, find that timing and be efficient and probably be a pretty nice tandem there.
I know, remembering back to last year, that when the Duffy trade was made, Brad Miller wasn't thrilled to be moving away from the left side of the infield over to first base, but he said all the right things. And I know, Bill, you talked about how he did the right things in the clubhouse and everything, and he kind of accepted where they were headed. First base was such a black hole in a way last year. They just couldn't find the right guy to fit into that spot throughout the whole season. How confident are you that Brad Miller is going to be able to fix that issue that this team faced last year?
Well, you know, I'm sure if you talk to him, he's still a shortstop. So, but it looked really good over there, and you know, kicking and screaming, and I really respected the way he, you know, said that he still wanted to play shortstop. You know, he didn't give up his dream, but you know, he moves over to first for the team. And you know, if you take away his first month of the season last year, and of course, you know, that's a big if, you know, his numbers would have really been off the charts. So he's got power, he can run, and, you know, bringing a shortstop's glove over to first, you know, you would think that's an upgrade. So, but it's like any position in the major leagues, you have to learn the nuances and how to play the thing. So, you know, I'm sure there's still a little bit of a learning curve, you know, where everything's not coming natural to him, where he runs over to one place or, you know, where he's supposed to be when this cutoff is made and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and obviously the right side of the infield so much different from the ball coming off the bat to who gets that ball down the right to the right side, second baseman versus first baseman. But that's what spring training's for, I guess. Then when you look at the bench, as far as the infield goes, Tim Beckham is obviously there. Nick Franklin, are those the two main guys, or are there some young guys that could step up here in spring training and find a spot in a reserve role?
Oh, I think Robertson could definitely, you know, be in that mix. And, you know, I still like Beckham myself. I think Beckham's, you know, a really good athlete. And I thought he showed it on a lot of occasions last year. And, of course, Franklin came a long way last year. And he's, you know, he's probably the front runner as far as their main utility guy just based on what he did last year. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't count Beckham out, and I really wouldn't be surprised if Robertson made the team.
Certainly plenty of options. Overall, a look at this infield from right now to maybe a year ago, Bill, I just get the impression that there's a lot less questions and a lot more kind of solid, and you know what you're going to get from this infield than what this team was facing heading into 2016.
Well, you know, you dust off the memory and you try to think back, and they were headed to spring training with three first basemen, including James Loney. We had Logan Morrison and Steve Pierce. And then Longo, you had to wonder if he was getting a little bit long in the tooth, because the year before was, you know, it was kind of a succession of years that weren't up to his numbers. They were still good numbers. Really, the only thing they had that was locked into place, I felt like going into last year, you know, I mean, Longo obviously is, but Forsythe. And, you know, Miller, I thought, had question marks going into last year. And even in spring training, we saw a lot of, you know, some throwing type issues that appeared during the season some, and then he got better. And so who knows where it's at. You know, I kind of felt it, from somebody looking at it and watching it, you kind of felt like it was something in his head. But, you know, that's being the armchair psychiatrist. But definitely the infield looks a lot better heading into spring training than it did last year.
All right, so we've covered the outfield and the infield so far, Bill. Great stuff from you as we work our way around the roster for this Rays team getting ready for spring training. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rays edition. For Bill Chastain, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here again, joined on the line by MLB.com Red Sox reporter Ian Brown. For the podcast this week, Ian, we continue to make our way around this roster and get fans ready for the 2017 Red Sox, and we're going to do this week on the infield, which is an intriguing spot. There's going to be some change from 2016, obviously, over to 2017. We'll get to sure things as well. The bench, we'll look at it all. I want to start with the changes, though, and that's basically the corners. And we might as well start with the Panda at third base. Pablo Sandoval, obviously, the hope is, and maybe a successful Red Sox season in some degree depends upon Pablo Sandoval bouncing back from the injuries of 2016 and the just poor play of 2015 and finally kind of be the guy that the Red Sox thought they signed heading into the 2015 season. So far, the picture test, all signs look good. The question is, do those images we've seen of a trimmed down Pablo Sandoval translate to a good ball player? And I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, I mean, certainly all eyes are going to be on the Panda, you know, going into spring training. He's kind of the big question mark. You wonder what you're going to get out of him. And this would have been a much different story, Tim, if they had held on to Travis Shaw, if they had held on to Yoan Moncada, and then you would have more of a competition. But right now, it's really Sandoval's job to lose. To his credit, he's done a great job of getting into shape. He's taken up boxing. He's done everything in his power. We're going to get our eyes on him for the first time this weekend at the Red Sox Winter Weekend. He's scheduled to attend that at Foxwoods, so it'll be very interesting to see both kind of how he presents there and kind of his message when he speaks to the media. He had a kind of an unfortunate tone at this time last year when he came in the spring training really heavy and was sort of in denial and said he hadn't weighed himself all winter and yada yada. So I think you'll hear a much better representation of Pablo Sandoval a year later.
Yeah, and you mentioned the guys that they let go, and I mean, if Moncada is still in the organization, I think most fans would almost be rooting for the changing of the guard, but that's not the case. Instead, you have Chris Sale, which is a nice trade-off, certainly, and you need Pablo Sandoval to produce. All right, across the diamond over to first base, Hanley Ramirez is still on this roster, and he did such a good job for this team at first base in 2016. Speaking of bounce-back seasons with the bat, and really, you got to give him a ton of credit for what he did becoming a first baseman, because I think Red Sox fans were just hoping to get by, and he ended up becoming a solid guy over there. But they go out and they improve at first base from a defensive standpoint, and Hanley looks like he's headed for a much bigger role as far as the DH goes. And Mitch Moreland will be the guy, for the most part, at first base. Just how good a defender is Mitch Moreland at first base?
Yeah, Mitch Moreland is a really good defender. You know, he won a Gold Glove last year. That's something right there. You know, haven't seen him play a whole lot, but everything I've heard is that hard worker, very good defensively. And I think the big thing that gives Hanley a little bit of a chance to, you know, staff those legs and maybe just focus more on his hitting, and his bat is such a weapon, kind of like David Ortiz could just put all his attention into his at-bat, and he would study pitchers between at-bats and things like that. And I think that, you know, you'll see Hanley. He looks up to David so much. I'm sure he's very familiar with what his routine was. So I think that Hanley's actually excited about moving to DH, where a lot of players are sort of leery of that.
And a lot of players struggle with that without being in the field and just focusing on those at-bats. But how much will Hanley benefit from the fact that he was teammates with Big Poppy for a couple of seasons and kind of saw how he did it?
Yeah, quite a bit. And Hanley just loves to hit, too. So he can, like I said, sort of put most of his eggs in that basket and just you know, focus on the bat. And his bat was such a pleasant spot, such a pleasant thing for them last year. but sort of, sort of built up as the year went along. Well, he got off to a modest start handling it. A lot of people forget he didn't start out like gangbusters. As a matter of fact, the first couple of months of the season, people were wondering, where is Hanley's power gone? Is his power going to come back? And he just had, a monster second half where he carried this team a lot of times in the second half of the season. And you just hope that, he can build off that this year.
How about Moreland's bat? I mean, I know they don't expect to get the kind of production that Hanley delivered from first base, but he's a guy that can at least give you some home runs. The average might not be there. He's maybe not the prototype power-hitting first baseman, but what should the Red Sox be expecting from him as far as offensive production?
Yeah, I think with Moreland, they feel that he can hit better than he has. The tools are there. And I know David Ortiz, of all people, was kind of high on Moreland when we talked to him in the Dominican, and this was even before the Red Sox signed him. It was kind of a casual conversation where, we were talking about the Gold Glove, and Ortiz said, "Oh, who won the Gold Glove last year, by the way?" And one of the writers said, it was Mitch Moreland. And he just unprompted was like, "Oh, I really like that guy. I think if he gets some playing time, he's going to develop into a real threat." And for Moreland, it's a case of, if he can learn to use the opposite field a little bit more at Fenway, I think he could, really turn into a 280 type of guy, maybe. And a lot of left-handed hitters, really, people think it's a part for right-handed hitters. In a lot of cases, it's a part for left-handed hitters if they can go up to the opposite field. So I think that, Moreland could be a nice piece there towards the bottom of the lineup.
All right, and then as we shift to the middle of the infield, you got to like what you see there. Shortstop and second base, the double play combination. Xander Bogaerts and Dustin Pedroia. Let's start with Bogaerts. He had the great hitting streak last year. He played a ton of games, Ian, and I think we've talked about it before, that maybe he wore down a little bit. Is that his focus here, or the team's focus? I guess it works two ways. One, for him to be in that prime condition that he can go the long haul without tiring, and then they need to get him a little more rest.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And, he had a situation last year where the Red Sox, they lost Brockle for a while when he had that, a concussion he had that knocked him out for a while. And B, Brock was needed a lot in left field, so that kind of took away your backup shortstop. And if you can keep Brock kind of available to spot Xander Bogaerts more this year, he's a nice fill-in at shortstop. So I think they do need to do a better job of, getting him off his feet, because he, watching him, he did wear down last year.
And the great thing I think you saw from Bogaerts also in 2016 was the power finally came, and fans have been kind of waiting for that, and he finally delivered with the plus 20 home runs. And it was something that was almost inevitable when you look at this guy and his body and what he can do. And he finally got that 20 plus power season in as far as home runs go, 89 RBIs, really a great season for Bogaerts. And he's just steady at shortstop. And then I guess we'll call him the captain at second, Dustin Pedroia. He's got to stay healthy is always the question with Pedroia because of the way he plays. But it seemed like the way 2016 went for Pedroia, he's really in a good place heading into this season.
Yeah, I think so. Pedroia comes out of a really healthy season for the first time in a long time. We're not talking about him recovering from this injury or that injury. He did have a very minor knee surgery at the end of last season, but that was just a maintenance thing more than anything else. So I think that you feel really good about where he's at. Nobody works harder, and I think that, even when David Ortiz was there, I thought in a lot of ways that Pedroia was the captain of the team. That's going to continue. His leadership becomes even more important now. He really set the tone with his work ethic. He just has a nice way of motivating guys behind the scenes. The fans never see it, but this guy is really the ultimate leader. And, 33 years old, but, he can still get the job done.
I used to think of him as more of a leader by example kind of guy, but as he's gotten older, does he do more talking than he did when he was a younger player?
He does, and he kind of does it in a different way, where he just sort of talks trash to these guys, tells them how much he's doing, and, they better keep up, and it's sort of a real subtle thing, but he's definitely the leader of the team, no doubt about it.
It works when you're 33 and you show those young guys how hard you're working. They can't help but jump in. All right, when you look at the bench, there's a lot of interesting things. Obviously, Brock Holt is a lock here to be playing all over the diamond, and we talked about him a little bit when we talked about the outfield. Josh Rutledge, they went Rule 5 draft, brought him back. Is he going to be on this roster? How does he fit in?
Yeah, I think Josh Fellers will make this team. He's a nice compliment off the bench with Brock Holt. You have the nice righty-lefty. You can mix and match those guys and interchange them almost, during games. You know, say you bring Brock Holt in to face a righty later in the game. You can use Rutledge to face a lefty. So I think they would like Josh Rutledge to make the team. Marco Hernandez will be in the mix for that spot as well. But I think there was a reason they took Rutledge back in that Rule 5 draft. And I think they really envisioned a role for him on this team. I think that the way the roster is constructed, I think that they really think that he fits.
You mentioned Marco Hernandez. The one other guy I guess maybe you could throw in as a guy that could be bouncing up and down between Pawtucket and Boston, Devin Marrero, still listed, I think, technically as a prospect for the Red Sox. What is the team's viewpoint at this point of Devin Marrero?
Yeah, I mean, his path has been blocked in a way because, the one place he probably could have helped you was sort of in that utility spot. And Brock Holt, I mean, there aren't many guys in baseball who are better at that role than Holt. So as long as you're going to have Holt at pretty affordable money here, as a utility guy, so valuable, it sort of blocks what Marrero can do. We still don't know what Marrero can do offensively. We know he's pretty good defensively. So, you wonder if his days are kind of numbered at the organization. It's just, he can only be a prospect for too long. Maybe he needs a fresh start somewhere else.
Yeah, certainly. And his brother has kind of passed him by, I think, as far as getting to the majors steadily in the Mets organization. But we'll see if Devin Marrero gets a shot in 2017 to finally show kind of what he can do. It would take an injury, I guess, to do that. All right, great stuff as always, Ian. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Red Sox edition. We will continue our trip around the Red Sox roster next week.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.